Chapter 35. Tel Megiddo, Israel. Next morning, Gabriel went to Armageddon. He left his Skoda in the parking lot of the visitor's center and hiked up the footpath to the top of the mount through the searing sunlight. He paused for a moment to gaze out across the Jezreel Valley. For Gabriel, the valley was the place of his birth. But biblical scholars and those obsessed by end-time prophecies believed it would be the setting for the apocalyptic confrontation between the forces of good and evil. Regardless of what calamity might lay ahead, Tel Megiddo had already witnessed much bloodshed. Located at the crossroads between Syria, Egypt, and Mesopotamia, it had been the site of dozens of major battles over the millennia. Assyrians, Israelites, Canaanites, Egyptians, Philistines, Greeks, Romans, and Crusaders all had shed blood beneath this hillock. Napoleon defeated the Ottomans there in 1799, and a little more than a century later, General Allenby of the British Army defeated them again. The soil on the top of the hill was cut by a labyrinth of trenches and pits. Tel Megiddo had been under intermittent archaeological excavation for more than a century. So far, researchers had discovered evidence that the city atop the mount had been destroyed and rebuilt some 25 times. A dig was underway at the moment. From one of the trenches came the sound of English, spoken with an American accent. Gabriel walked over and looked down. Two American college students, a boy and a girl, were hunched over something in the soil. Bones, thought Gabriel, but he couldn't be sure. I'm looking for Professor Lavon. He's working in K this morning. It was the girl who'd spoken to him. I don't understand. The excavation trenches are laid out in a grid pattern. Each plot is lettered. That way we can chart the location of every artifact. You're standing next to F. See the sign? Professor Lavon is working in K. Gabriel made his way over to the pit marked K and looked down. At the bottom of the trench, 2 meters below the surface, crouched an elfin figure wearing a broad-brimmed straw hat. He was scratching at the hard subsoil with a small pick and appeared thoroughly engrossed in his work. But then he usually did. Find anything interesting, Eli? The picking stopped. The figure looked over his shoulder.
Just a few pieces of broken pottery, he said. How about you?
Gabriel reached down into the trench. Eli Lavon took hold of Gabriel's hand and pulled himself out. They sat in the shade of a blue tarpaulin and drank mineral water at a folding table. Gabriel, his eyes on the valley below, asked Lavon what he was doing at Tel Megiddo.
There's a popular school of archaeological thought these days called biblical minimalism. The minimalists believe, among other things, that King Solomon was a mythical figure, something of a Jewish King Arthur. We're trying to prove them wrong.
Did he exist?
Of course, said Lavon. And he built a city right here at Megiddo.
Lavon removed his floppy hat and used it to beat the gray-brown dust from his khaki trousers. As usual, he seemed to be wearing all of his clothing at once. 3 shirts, by Gabriel's count, with a red cotton handkerchief knotted at his throat. His sparse, unkempt gray hair moved in the faint breeze. He pushed a stray lock from his forehead and appraised Gabriel with a pair of quick brown eyes. Isn't it a little soon for you to be up here in this heat? The last time Gabriel had seen Lavon, he'd been lying in a hospital bed in the Hadassah Medical Center.
I'm only a volunteer. I work for a few hours in the early morning. My doctor says it's good therapy.
Lavon sipped his mineral water.
Besides, I find this place provides a valuable lesson in humility.
What's that?
People come and go from this place, Gabriel. Our ancestors ruled it briefly a very long time ago. Now we rule it again. But one day we'll be gone too. The only question is how long will we be here this time, and what will we leave behind for men like me to unearth in the future? I hope it's something more than the footprint of a separation fence.
I'm not ready to give up just yet, Eli.
So I gather. You've been a busy boy. I've been reading about you in the newspapers. That's not a good thing in your line of work, being in the newspapers.
It was your line of work, too.
Once, he said, a long time ago.
Lavon had been a promising young archaeologist in September 1972, when Shamron recruited him to be a member of the Wrath of God team. He'd been an Ayin, a tracker. He'd followed the Black Septembrists and learned their habits. In many ways, his job had been the most dangerous of all, because he had been exposed to the terrorists for days on end with no backup. The work had left him with a nervous disorder and chronic intestinal problems.
How much do you know about the case, Eli? I'd heard through the grapevine you were back in the country, something to do with the Rome bombing. Then Shamron showed up at my door one evening and told me you were chasing Sabri's boy. Is it true? Did little Khaled really do Rome?
He's not a little boy anymore. He did Rome, and he did Gare de Lyon, and Buenos Aires, and Istanbul before that.
It doesn't surprise me. Terrorism is in Khaled's veins. He drank it with his mother's milk.
Lavon shook his head.
You know, if I'd been watching your back in France like I did in the old days, none of this would have happened.
That's probably true, Eli. Lavon's street skills were legendary. Shamron always said that Eli Lavon could disappear while shaking your hand. Once a year, he went to the academy to pass along the secrets of his trade to the next generation. Indeed, the watchers who'd been in Marseille had probably spent time sitting at Lavon's feet.
So, what brings you to Armageddon?
Gabriel laid a photograph on the tabletop.
Handsome devil, Lavon said. Who is he?
Gabriel laid a second version of the same photo on the table. This one included the figure seated at the subject's left, Yasser Arafat.
Khaled?
Gabriel nodded.
What does this have to do with me?
I think you and Khaled might have something in common.
What's that?
Gabriel looked out at the excavation trenches. A trio of American students joined them beneath the shade of the tarpaulin. Lavon and Gabriel excused themselves and walked slowly around the perimeter of the dig. Gabriel told him everything, beginning with the dossier discovered in Milan and ending with the information Nabil Azouri had brought out of Ain el Hilwe. Lavon listened without asking questions, but Gabriel could see in Lavon's clever brown eyes that he was already making connections and searching for further avenues of exploration. He was more than just a skilled surveillance artist. Like Gabriel, Lavon was the child of Holocaust survivors. After the Wrath of God operation, he had settled in Vienna and opened a small investigative bureau called Wartime Claims and Inquiries. Operating on a shoestring budget, he had managed to track down millions of dollars in looted Jewish assets and had played a significant role in prying a multi-billion dollar settlement from the banks of Switzerland. 5 months earlier, a bomb had exploded at Lavon's office. Lavon's two assistants were killed. Lavon, seriously injured, had been in a coma for several weeks. The man who planted the bomb had been working for Eric Radek.
So, you think Fella Altamari knew Khaled?
Without question.
It seems a bit out of character to remain hidden all those years. He must have been a careful chap.
That's true, Gabriel said, but he knew that Fella would be killed in the bombing of the Gare de Lyon, and that his secret would be protected. She was in love with him, and he lied to her.
I see your point.
But the most compelling piece of evidence that they knew each other comes from her father. Fella told him to burn the letters and the photographs she'd sent over the years. That means Khaled must have been in them.
As Khaled?
Gabriel shook his head. It was more threatening than that. She must have mentioned him by his other name, his French name.
So, you think Khaled met the girl under ordinary circumstances and recruited her sometime after?
That's the way he'd play it, Gabriel said. That's how his father would have played it, too.
They could have met anywhere.
Or they could have met somewhere just like this.
A dig? She was an archaeology student. Maybe Khaled was, too. Or maybe he was a professor, like you. Or maybe he was just some good-looking Arab guy she met in a bar.
We know her name, Eli. We know she was a student, and that she studied archaeology. If we follow the trail of Fela, it will lead us back to Khaled, I'm sure of it.
So follow the trail.
For obvious reasons, I can't go back to Europe just yet.
Why not turn it over to the office and let their searchers do the job?
Because after the fiasco in Paris, there's not going to be an appetite for having another go at Khaled on European soil, at least not officially. Besides, I am the office, and I'm giving it to you. I want you to find him, Eli, quietly. That's your special gift. You know how to do these sorts of things without making a racket.
True, but I've lost a step or two.
Are you fit enough to travel?
As long as there's no rough stuff, that's your department. I'm the bookish one. You're the muscle Jew.
Lavon dug a cigarette from his shirt pocket and lit it, cupping his hand against the breeze. He looked out over the valley of Jezreel for a moment before speaking again.
But you always were. Weren't you, Gabriel?
What's that?
The muscle Jew. You like to play the role of the sensitive artist, but deep down, you're more like Shamron than you realize.
He's going to kill again. Maybe he'll wait until next April, or maybe a target will come along sooner, something that will allow him to temporarily quench his thirst for Jewish blood.
Maybe you suffer from the same thirst?
A little, Gabriel conceded.
But this isn't about revenge. It's about justice. And it's about protecting the lives of innocents.
Will you find him for me, Eli?
Lavon nodded.
Don't worry, Gabriel. I'll find him. Before he can kill again.
They stood in silence for a moment, looking down at the land. Did we drive them out, Eli?
The Canaanites?
No, Eli. The Arabs.
We certainly didn't ask them to stay,
Lavon said.
Maybe it was easier that way.
A blue sedan was idling in Narcus Street. Gabriel recognized the face of the man seated behind the wheel. He entered the apartment house and climbed quickly up the stairs. Two suitcases stood on the landing outside the half-open door. Chiara was seated in the living room, dressed in a smart black European two-piece suit and high-heeled shoes. Her face had makeup on it. Gabriel had never seen Chiara with makeup before.
Where are you going?
You know better than to ask me that.
A job?
Yes, of course. A job.
How long will you be gone? Her silence told him she was not coming back.
When it's over, I'm going back to Venice.
Then she added,
to take care of my family.
He stood motionless and looked down at her. Chiara's tears, when they spilled down her cheeks, were black with mascara. To Gabriel, they looked like streaks of dirty rain on a statue. She wiped them away and examined her blackened fingertips, angry at her inability to control her emotions. Then she straightened her back and blinked hard several times.
You look disappointed in me, Gabriel.
For what?
Crying. You never cry, do you?
Not anymore. He sat down next to her and tried to hold her hand. She drew it away from him and dabbed at her smudged makeup with a tissue. Then she opened a compact case and looked at her reflection in the mirror.
I can't get on a plane looking like this.
Good.
Don't get any ideas. I'm still leaving. Besides, it's what you want. You would never tell me to leave. You're far too decent for that. But I know you want me to go.
She snapped the compact shut.
I don't blame you. In a strange way, I love you more. Only I wish you hadn't told me that you wanted to marry me.
I did, he said.
Did? I do want to marry you, Chiara.
He hesitated.
But I can't. I'm married to Leah. Fidelity, right, Gabriel? Devotion to duty or to one's obligations. Loyalty, faithfulness.
I can't leave her now. Not after what she's just been put through by Khaled.
In another week, she won't remember it.
Kiara, noticing the color in Gabriel's face, took his hand.
God, I'm sorry. Please forget I ever said that.
It's forgotten.
You're a fool to let me walk out of here. No one will ever love you the way I've loved you.
She stood up.
But we'll see each other again, I'm sure. Who knows? Maybe I'll be working for you soon.
What are you talking about?
The office is swirling with rumors.
It usually is. You shouldn't pay attention to rumors, Kiara.
I once heard a rumor that you'd never leave Leah to marry me. I wish I'd paid attention to that one.
She slung her bag over her shoulder, then bent down and kissed Gabriel's lips.
One last kiss, she whispered.
At least let me drive you to the airport.
The last thing we need is a tearful goodbye at Ben-Gurion. Help me with my bags.
He carried the suitcases down and loaded them in the trunk of the car. Kiara climbed into the back seat and closed the door without looking at him. Gabriel stood in the shade of a eucalyptus tree and watched the car drive off. As he walked upstairs to the empty apartment, he realized he hadn't asked her to stay. Eli had been right. It was easier that way. Chapter 36. Tiberias, Israel. A week after Kiara's departure, Gabriel drove to Tiberias for dinner at the Shamrons. Yonatan was there, along with his wife and three young children. So was Ramona and her husband. They both had just come off duty and were still in uniform. Shamron, surrounded by his family, seemed happier than Gabriel had seen him in years. After supper, he led Yonatan and Gabriel onto the terrace. A bright three-quarter moon was reflected in the calm surface of the Sea of Galilee. Beyond the lake, black and shapeless, loomed the Golan Heights. Shamron liked it best on his terrace, because it faced east toward his enemies. He was content to sit quietly and say nothing for a time while Gabriel and Yonatan talked pessimistically about the Matzav, the situation. After a while, Shamron gave Yonatan a look that said he needed to speak to Gabriel privately.
I get the message, Abba,
Yonatan said, getting to his feet.
I'll leave you to it.
He is a colonel in the IDF, Gabriel said when Yonatan had gone. He doesn't like it when you treat him like that.
Yonatan has his line of work and we have ours.
Shamron adroitly shifted the focus from his personal problems to Gabriel's.
How's Leah?
I'm taking her to the Mount of Olives tomorrow to see Dani's grave.
I assume her doctor has approved this outing?
He's coming with us, along with half the staff of the Mount Herzl Psychiatric Hospital.
Shamron lit a cigarette.
Have you heard from Kiara?
No, and I don't expect to.
Do you know where she is? Shamron looked theatrically at his wristwatch.
If the operation is proceeding as planned, she's probably sipping brandy in a ski lodge in Zermatt with a certain Swiss gentleman of questionable character. This gentleman is about to ship a rather large consignment of arms to a Lebanese guerrilla group that doesn't have our best interests at heart. We'd like to know when that shipment is leaving port and where it's going.
Please, tell me operations isn't using my former fiancé as bait in a honey trap.
I'm not privy to the details of the operation, only the overarching goals. As for Kiara, she's a girl of high moral character. I'm sure she'll play hard to get with our Helvetian friend.
I still don't like it.
Don't worry, Shamron said. Soon, you'll be the one deciding how we use her.
What are you talking about?
The Prime Minister would like a word with you. He has a job he'd like you to take.
Javelin catcher?
Shamron threw back his head and laughed, then suffered a long, spasmodic fit of coughing.
Actually, He wants you to be the next director of operations.
Me? By the time Lev's committee of inquiry has finished with me, I'll be lucky to get a job as a security guard at a cafe in Ben Yehuda Street.
You'll come out of it just fine. Now is not the time for public self-flagellation. Leave that for the Americans. If we have to tell a few half-truths, if we must lie to a country like France that is not interested in our survival, then so be it.
By way of deception, thou shalt do war, Gabriel said, reciting the motto of the office. Shamron nodded once more and said, Amen.
Even if I come out of it in one piece, Lev won't allow me to have operations.
He won't have a say in the matter. Lev's term is ending, and he has few friends in King Saul Boulevard or Kaplan Street. He won't be invited to stay for a second dance.
So who's going to be the next chief?
The Prime Minister and I have a short list of names. None of them are office. Whoever we select, he'll need an experienced man running operations.
I knew it was leading to this, Gabriel said. I knew it the moment I saw you in Venice.
I admit, my motives are selfish. My term is coming to an end, too. If the Prime Minister goes, so do I. And this time, there won't be a return from exile. I need you, Gabriel. I need you to keep watch over my creation.
The office? Shamron shook his head, then lifted his hand toward the land.
I know you'll do it, Shamron said. You have no choice. Your mother named you Gabriel for a reason. Michael is the highest. But you, Gabriel, you are the mightiest. You're the one who defends Israel against its accusers. You're the angel of judgment, the prince of fire.
Gabriel, silent, looked out at the lake.
There's something I need to take care of first.
Eli will find him. Especially with the clues you've given him. That was a brilliant piece of detective work on your part. But then you always did have that kind of mind.
It was Fella, Gabriel said. She doomed him by telling me her story.
But that's the Palestinian way. They're trapped in their narrative of loss and exile. There's no escaping it.
Shamron leaned forward, resting his elbows on his knees.
Are you really sure you want the job of turning Khaled into a martyr? There are other boys who can do it for you.
I know, he said, but I need to do it.
Shamron sighed heavily.
If you must. But it's going to be a private affair this time. No teams, no surveillance, nothing Khaled can manipulate to his advantage. Just you and him.
As it should be. A silence fell between them. They watched the running lights of a fishing boat steaming slowly toward Tiberias.
There's something I need to ask you, Gabriel said.
You want to talk to me about Tochnit Dalet, Shamron said. About Beit Said and Sumaria.
How did you know?
You've been wandering the wilderness of Palestinian pain for a long time now. It's only natural.
He asked Shamron the same question he'd put to Eli Lavon a week earlier at Megiddo.
Did we drive them out?
Of course we did, Shamron said. Then hastily he added, in a few places, under specific circumstances. And if you ask me, we should have driven more out. That was where we went wrong.
You can't be serious, Ari.
Let me explain, he said. History dealt us a losing hand. In 1947, the United Nations decided to give us a scrap of land to found our new state. Remember, four-fifths of mandatory Palestine had already been cut away to create the state of Transjordan. 80%. Of the final 20%, the United Nations gave us half. 10% of mandatory Palestine, the coastal plain and the Negev. And still the Arabs said no. Imagine if they'd said yes. Imagine if they'd said yes in 1937 when the Peel Commission recommended partition. How many millions might we have saved? Your grandparents would still be alive. My parents and my sisters might still be alive. But what did the Arabs do? They said no. And they aligned themselves with Hitler and cheered our extermination.
Does that justify expelling them?
No. And that's not the reason why we did it. They were expelled as a consequence of war. A war they initiated. The land the UN gave us contained 500,000 Jews and 400,000 Arabs. Those Arabs were a hostile force, committed to our destruction. We knew that the minute we declared our independence, we were going to be the target of a pan-Arab military invasion. We had to prepare the battlefield. We couldn't fight two wars at the same time. We couldn't fight the Egyptians and the Jordanians with one hand, while battling the Arabs of Beit Said and Sumaria with the other. They had to go.
Shamron could see that Gabriel remained unconvinced.
Tell me something, Gabriel. Do you think that if the Arabs had won the war, that there would be any Jewish refugees? Look what happened in Hebron. They brought the Jews to the center of town and cut them down. They attacked a convoy of doctors and nurses heading up Mount Scopus and butchered them all. To make sure no one survived, they doused the vehicles with gasoline and set them alight. This was the nature of our enemy. Their goal was to kill us all, so we would never come back. And that remains their goal today. They want to kill us all.
Gabriel recited to Shamron the words Fella had spoken to him on the road to Paris.
My Holocaust is as real as yours, and yet you deny my suffering and exonerate yourself of guilt. You claim my wounds are self-inflicted.
They are self-inflicted, Shamron said.
But was there a blanket strategy of expulsion? Did you engage in ethnic cleansing as a matter of policy?
No, Shamron said, and the proof is all around us. You had dinner the other night in Abu Ghosh. If there was a blanket policy of expulsion, why is Abu Ghosh still there? In the Western Galilee, why is Sumaria gone, but Al-Makar still there? Because the residents of Abu Ghosh and Al-Makar didn't try to butcher us. But maybe that was our mistake. Maybe we should have expelled them all, instead of trying to retain an Arab minority in our midst.
Then there would have been more refugees.
True. But if they had no hope of ever returning, perhaps they might have integrated themselves into Jordan and Lebanon, instead of allowing themselves to be used as a propaganda tool to demonize and delegitimize us. Why is Fella Altamari's father still in Ain el-Hilweh, after all these years? Why didn't any of his brother Arab states, nations with whom he shares a common language, culture, and religion, why didn't any of them take him in? Because they want to use him as a tool to question my right to exist. I'm here. I live. I breathe. I exist. I don't need anyone's permission to exist. I don't need anyone's approval. And I certainly have nowhere else to go.
He looked at Gabriel.
I just need you to watch over it for me. My eyes aren't what they used to be.
The lights of the fishing boat disappeared into the port of Tiberias. Shamron seemed suddenly weary.
There will never be peace in this place.
But then there never was. Ever since we stumbled into this land from Egypt and Mesopotamia, we've been fighting. Canaanites, Assyrians, Philistines, Romans, Amalekites. We deluded ourselves into believing our enemies had given up their dream of destroying us. We have prayed for impossible things. Peace without justice, forgiveness without restitution.
He looked provocatively at Gabriel. Love without sacrifice?
Gabriel stood and prepared to take his leave.
What shall I tell the Prime Minister?
Tell him I have to think about it.
Operations is only a way station, Gabriel. One day, you'll be the chief, the Memuna.
You're the Memuna, Ari. You always will be. Shamron gave a satisfied laugh.
What shall I tell him, Gabriel?
Tell him I have nowhere else to go either. The telephone call from Julian Isherwood provided Gabriel with the excuse he'd been looking for to remove the last traces of Kiara from the flat. He contacted a charity for Russian immigrants and said he wished to make a donation. The following morning, two skinny boys from Moscow came and removed all the furniture from the living room, the couches and chairs, the end tables and lamps, the dining room table, even the decorative brass pots and ceramic dishes that Kiara had selected and placed with such care. The bedroom he left untouched, except for the sheets and the duvet, which still bore the vanilla scent of Kiara's hair. During the days that followed, Narkis Street was visited by a succession of delivery trucks. The large white examination table arrived first, followed by the fluorescent and halogen lamps with adjustable stanchions. The venerable art supply shop of L. Cornelison and Son, Great Russell Street, London, dispatched a shipment of brushes, pigment, medium, and varnish. A chemical firm in Leeds sent several cases of potentially dangerous solvents that aroused more than the passing interest of the Israeli postal authorities. From Germany came a costly microscope on a retractable arm. From a workshop in Venice, two large oaken easels. Daniel in the Lion's Den. Oil on canvas, dubiously attributed to Erasmus Quilinus, arrived the following day. It took Gabriel the better part of the afternoon to disassemble the sophisticated shipping crate, and only with Shamron's help was he able to maneuver the enormous canvas onto the twin easels. The image of Daniel surrounded by wild beasts intrigued Shamron, and he stayed late into the evening, as Gabriel, armed with cotton swabs and a basin of distilled water and ammonia, began the tedious task of scrubbing more than a century's worth of dirt and grime from the surface of the painting. To the degree possible, he duplicated his work habits from Venice. He rose before it was light and resisted the impulse to switch on the radio, lest the daily toll of bloodshed and constant security alerts break the spell the painting had cast over him. He would remain in his studio all morning, and usually worked the second shift late into the night. He spent as little time as possible at King Saul Boulevard. Indeed, he heard of Lev's resignation on the car radio while driving from Narkis Street to Mount Herzl to see Leah. During their visits together, her journeys to Vienna were shallower and shorter in duration. She asked him questions about their past.
"Where did we meet, Gabriel?"
"At Bezalel. You're a painter, Leah."
"Where were we married?"
"In Tiberias, on Shamron's terrace, overlooking the Sea of Galilee."
"And you're a restorer now?"
"I studied in Venice with Umberto Conti. You used to visit me there every few months. You posed as a German girl from Bremen. Do you remember, Leah?" One searing afternoon in June, Gabriel had coffee with Dr. Barzvi in the staff canteen.
"Will she ever be able to leave this place?"
"No."
"What about for short periods?"
"Oh, I don't see why not," the doctor said. "In fact, I think it sounds like a rather good idea."
She came with a nurse the first few times. Then, as she grew more comfortable being away from the hospital, Gabriel brought her home alone. She sat in a chair in his studio and watched him work for hours on end. Sometimes her presence brought him peace. Sometimes, unbearable pain. Always he wished he could set her upon his easel and recreate the woman he had placed in a car that snowy night in Vienna.
"Do you have any of my paintings?"
He showed her the portrait in the bedroom.
When she asked who the model had been, Gabriel said it was him.
"You look sad."
"I was tired," he said. "I'd been gone for 3 years."
"Did I really paint this?"
"You were good," he said. "You were better than me." One afternoon, while Gabriel was retouching a damaged portion of Daniel's face, she asked him why she had come to Vienna. "We'd grown apart because of my work. I thought my cover was secure enough to bring you and Dani along. It was a foolish mistake. And you were the one to pay for it."
"There was another woman, wasn't there? A French girl? Someone who worked for the office?"
Gabriel nodded once and returned to work on the face of Daniel. Leah pressed him for more.
"Who did it?"
she asked.
"Who put the bomb in my car?"
"It was Arafat. I was supposed to die with you and Dani. But the man who carried out the mission changed the plan."
"Is he alive, this man?"
Gabriel shook his head.
"And Arafat?"
Leah's grasp on the present situation was tenuous at best. Gabriel explained that Yasser Arafat, Israel's mortal enemy, now lived a few miles away in Ramallah.
"Arafat is here? How can that be?"
"From the mouths of innocents," thought Gabriel. Just then he heard footfalls in the stairwell. Eli Lavon let himself into the flat without bothering to knock. Chapter 37. Aix-en-Provence. 5 months later. The first stirrings of a mistral were prowling the ravines and gorges of the Bouches-du-Rhône. Paul Martineau, climbing out of his Mercedes sedan, buttoned his canvas field coat and turned the collar up round his ears. Another winter had come to Provence. A few more weeks, he thought, then he'd have to shut down the dig until spring. He retrieved his canvas rucksack from the trunk, then set out along the edge of the ancient stone wall of the hill fort. A moment later, at the point where the wall ended, he paused. About 50 meters away, near the edge of the hilltop, a painter stood before a canvas. It was not unusual to see artists working atop the hill. Cézanne himself had adored the commanding view over the Chêne de l'Étoile. Still, Martineau reckoned it would be wise to have a closer look at the man before starting to work. He transferred his Makarov pistol from his rucksack to the pocket of his coat, then walked toward the painter. The man's back was turned to Martineau. Judging from the attitude of his head, he was gazing at the distant Mont Sainte-Victoire. This was confirmed for Martineau a few seconds later, when he glimpsed the canvas for the first time. The work was very much in the style of Cézanne's classic landscape. Actually, thought Martineau, it was an uncanny reproduction. The artist was so engrossed in his work he seemed not to hear Martineau's approach. Only when Martineau was standing at his back did he cease painting and glance over his shoulder. He wore a heavy woolen sweater and a floppy, wide-brimmed hat that moved with the wind. His gray beard was long and unkempt. His hands were smeared with paint. Judging from his expression, he was a man who did not enjoy being interrupted while he was working. Martineau was sympathetic.
"You're obviously a devotee of Cézanne," said Martineau.
The painter nodded once, then resumed his work.
"It's quite good. Would you be willing to sell it to me?" "I'm afraid this one is spoken for, but I can do another if you'd like."
Martineau handed him his card.
"You can reach me at my office at the university. We'll discuss the price when I see the finished canvas."
The painter accepted the card and dropped it into a wooden case containing his paints and brushes. Martineau bid him a good morning, then set off across the site until he arrived at the excavation trench where he'd been working the previous afternoon. He climbed down into the pit and removed the blue tarpaulin spread over the bottom, exposing a stone-carved, severed head in semi-profile. He opened his rucksack and removed a small hand trowel and a brush. Just as he was about to begin working, a shadow darkened the base of the pit.
He rose onto his knees and looked up. He had expected to see Yvette, or one of the other archaeologists working on the dig. Instead, he saw the hatted silhouette of the painter, lit from behind by the bright sun. Martineau lifted his hand to his brow and shielded his eyes.
"Would you mind moving away from there? You're blocking my light."
The painter silently held up the card Martineau had just given him.
"I believe the name on this is incorrect."
"I beg your pardon?"
"The name says Paul Martineau."
"Yes, that's me."
"But it's not your real name, is it?"
Martineau felt a searing heat across the back of his neck. He looked carefully at the figure standing at the edge of the trench. Was it really him? Martineau couldn't be sure, not with the heavy beard and floppy hat. Then he thought of the landscape. It was a perfect imitation of Cézanne in tone and texture. Of course it was him. Martineau inched his hand toward his pocket and made one more play for time.
"Listen, my friend, my name is Khaled al-Khalifa," the painter said, finishing the sentence for him.
His next words were spoken in Arabic.
"Do you really want to die as a Frenchman? You're Khaled, son of Sabri, grandson of Assad, the Lion of Beit Said. Your father's gun is in your coat pocket. Reach for it. Tell me your name."
Khaled seized the grip of the Makarov and was pulling it from his pocket when the first round tore into his chest. The second shot caused the gun to slip from his grasp. He toppled backwards and struck his head against the rock-like base of the pit. As he slipped toward unconsciousness, he looked up and saw the Jew scooping a handful of earth from the mound at the edge of the trench. He tossed the soil into Khaled's face, then raised his gun for the final time. Khaled saw a flash of fire, then darkness. The trench began to spin, and he felt himself spiraling downward into the past. The painter slipped the Beretta back into the waistband of his trousers and walked back to the spot where he'd been working. He dipped his brush in black paint and signed his name to the canvas, then turned and started up the slope of the hill. In the shadow of the ancient wall, he encountered a girl with short hair who bore a vague resemblance to Fella Altamari. He bid her a good morning and climbed into the saddle of his motorcycle. A moment later, he was gone. Author's note: Prince of Fire is a work of fiction. That said, it is based heavily on real events and was inspired in large measure by a photograph. A photograph of a young boy at the funeral of his father, a master terrorist killed by agents of Israeli intelligence in Beirut in 1979. The terrorist was Black September's Ali Hassan Salama, architect of the Munich Olympics massacre and many other acts of murder, and the man upon whose lap the boy sits in the photograph is none other than Yasser Arafat. Students of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict will recognize that I borrowed much from Ali Hassan Salama and his famous father to construct the fictional Assad and Sabri al-Khalifa. There are key differences between the Salamas and the al-Khalifas, far too many to enumerate here. A search of the coastal plain will produce no evidence of a village called Beit Said, for no such place exists. Tokhnit Dalet was the real name of the plan to remove hostile Arab population centers from land allocated for the new state of Israel. There was once a village called Sumaria in the western Galilee. Its destruction occurred as described in the pages of this novel. Black September was indeed a covert arm of Yasser Arafat's Palestine Liberation Organization, and the consequences of its brief, bloody reign of terror live on today. It was Black September that first demonstrated the utility of carrying out spectacular acts of terrorism on the international stage, and evidence of its influence is all around us. It can be seen in a school in Beslan, in the wreckage of four trains in Madrid, and in the empty space in Lower Manhattan where the twin towers of the World Trade Center once stood. Yasser Arafat fell ill and died as I was completing this novel. Had he chosen the path of peace instead of unleashing a wave of terror, it would never have been written, and thousands of people, Israeli and Palestinian, would still be alive today.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Prince of Fire by Daniel Silva. Copyright 2005 by Daniel Silva. Read by Garen Berry. Performance copyright 2004 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan 49417.